felt really cool to be able to dig up this information and write the story, and it was like intoxicating. It's like, man, this is the gig for me. I'm going to get paid to just talk to people.
Discovered how much I like people and getting to know people and see how they tick and everything. So to me, every beat that you have, like, my favorite part about it is getting to figure out those personalities.
Now, from WGN Radio News, a look back at the day that was and a deeper look into issues and stories with Andrea Dahlers and the reporters on 720 WGN.
Thank you so much again for joining our show tonight. I'm Andrea Dahlers. Welcome again to another edition of Andrea and the Reporters. Three esteemed journalists in our midst tonight. Names you all have heard of, names you all know and love. Joan Esposito, Kristen McQuarrie, and Jim Webb. I'm so excited to have all of you in studio tonight. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I always like when I have different journalists on and people, heads turn in the hallway, and parents parents are fans now, as Kristen has been aware of now, made aware of, I should say, by my mom. But again, thank you guys for being here. Everybody has heard, everybody knows Joan Esposito. Everyone knows your name, Joan. Tell us where you are now and what you're doing.
Now I am the afternoon host at WCPT AM 820 Talk Radio. We are kind of a generally sort of political and issues-oriented station, though we do... because I love it, we do a lot of arts, too. A lot of theater, a lot of movies, and silly stuff, too.
It's fun. Do people still stop you and say, oh, Channel 5, even though it's been many years?
People still tell me they watch me every day. And for a while, I used to say, well, you know, I don't really do that anymore. Now I just say, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so happy you watch me every day.
Right. Just nod and agree.
Yes.
Nod and agree. Very cool. Welcome. Kristen McQuarrie, you are no stranger to WGN Radio. Frequent guest, frequent panelist, and frequent guest host of a podcast as well. Tell us where you are. I know people know who you are, but for those just maybe
don't.
Who have not been on the planet recently.
I am a member of the Tribune editorial board, so we write the unsigned opinion pieces that sort of take the position of the paper and try to use it as a cudgel to make public officials do what we think they should do. And I have a column that runs on Tuesdays in the paper.
Very good. And you are sometimes a frequent guest with John Williams and Eric Zorn. And
I am sometimes
podcasting here as well.
Every once in a while, yes.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
The reference before was, as I've told you now several times off the air, my mom is a big fan of yours and will clip your column and write me little notes about how she thinks you're a great journalist.
Well, so. Tell her thank you. And she's a Southlander. That's where, you know, that's where I got my start really in the Chicago area. So I have a strong affinity for Orland Park, over to Harvey. I mean, just spin me around and shoot me off, and that's kind of was really probably my favorite job, was that first job at the South Town.
Yeah, it's a good news town.
It is.
South Suburban,
oh, yeah.
County, Southern,
oh, yeah.
Cook, big.
Absolutely,
news area.
Yeah.
A lot of fun to cover. And Jim Webb, you know that name as well. Jim, you and I met many years ago in the lobby of the Tribune Tower, and I just called you Webb, and you called me Dahlers, and then I found out you were a big shot, and I thought, oh, gosh, I should either go with Jim or Mr. Webb. I wasn't so sure. But tell us about your path, Jim, and where you are now.
Thank you for that, and thanks for pairing me with a pair of radio professionals here, too. Really appreciate that, Andrea. I have not been a journalist for about 3 years now. For the last 3 years, I'm the operations director over at Serafin & Associates, a public affairs communications firm here in town, with another former journalist, Tom Serafin, who's the founder of that firm, and also a fellow member of the Sangamon State fraternity from Springfield Public Affairs Reporting Program, we'll probably talk about later. Kristen is, yeah, too. There's a few of us in town. So I was a political editor at the Trib for about 10 years before I came over to see Tom's firm and get a look at the other side of the street. We do a lot of work with firms and companies, big and small, and individuals who need public relations help. Specifically, usually communications in the public affairs arena, so somewhere in and around government.
Very good, very good. I think it's always in you, though. You know, you always might have this little case of FOMO, this fear of missing out, but I think it's always in you. I'll stop, no matter where I am, I'll stop. I was on vacation last week, and I always stop and have to check the local news and see what's happening. I think it's always in your blood. Do you guys feel that, too? I mean, even if
absolutely.
You're out of town, you're always tuned in or dialed in.
Absolutely. I mean, before I did this job full-time, I filled in for a while over at WBEZ, and one of the things that I loved the most is I could walk into that newsroom at 7:30 in the morning with the most obscure news fact that I had found, and everybody would have heard of it, and everybody had an opinion, and we would all be like, brr, 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 brr. And it, that's just, you know, news junkies like to be around other news junkies. What can I say?
I think it's true.
And they
I
get the jokes, too, right?
Mm-hmm. You know,
I find that out in the private sector. The jokes aren't quite the same as they are in
no,
the newsroom. People laugh at certain things certain ways when you're in
right.
the newsroom.
Or just right. the intricacy of what we talk about. You know, like, nobody cares about pensions, but it's all I can talk about. And my family's like, shut up about pensions.
I know.
But, yes, so we have this granular level of knowledge that regular people really don't care about.
Right. One of our first panels that we had on the show here, we had four street reporters, beat reporters, and the conversation went from current events to cleanest bathrooms and best place to eat it in the city at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're out covering a story, which I'm sure we've all at some point been, you know, in an area where it's like, all right, where's the cleanest bathroom and where can I get the best beef or where can I get just something to eat at 2 o'clock in the morning? So
yes.
It's all within us. Let's talk a little bit about your backgrounds and where y'all came from. Joan, let's start with you. Where'd you grow up and what made you want to become a journalist?
I grew up in a small town in Ohio, and I've told this story before, but I owe my journalism career to Bob Surratt.
Really?
Yes, in a backhanded way, because I was working, ended up in Columbus, Ohio, and I was working in entertainment television, and I was doing news for a radio station because they were both part-time jobs, which, of course, was totaled up to like 65 hours a week, but that's another story. And I loved working in television, but I loved working in news. And I also wanted to live in either New York, Chicago, or L.A. So I came to Chicago, and I did an audition for PM Magazine. Anybody old enough to remember PM Magazine?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was like, okay, I really want to live in Chicago. So if I get this job, I'm going to give up my dream of news, and I'll just stick with entertainment television. They wanted to hire me, but they had already made a deal with Bob Surratt, and because it's Chicago, they wanted an African-American and a Caucasian. So they said to me, we're really sorry, you did a great audition,
but
it just isn't going to work. So I was like, okay, the heck with it. So then I finally went into television news through a much more circuitous route. But then Bob Surratt never took the job.
No.
That's when he went to work for Channel 2. And so he never took the job. And if he had bailed beforehand, my whole career would have been completely different. So I owe everything to Bob Surratt.
No kidding. And Bob Surratt had a very successful show here on WGN Radio.
He's been successful. He's been at Channel 5.
Oh,
he's been at Channel 2. He's been at WGN. And, of course, his early radio days that I'm much too young to remember.
I remember. Okay, here's my Bob Surratt story is that when I was in, I want to say junior or senior in high school at Andrew High School in Tinley Park, we took a tour of the Channel 5 newsroom. And you probably remember this. So this would have been mid to late 90s. And Bob Surratt had his office on the corner and we were getting the tour and we said, who's in there in that office with no lights on? And there was a lava lamp and a neon sign. Right, Joan? Am I right? And he had the lava lamp and they went, that's Bob Surratt. And all the girls went, oh, he's so cute, because he had his little perm, little afro perm hair.
He used to grow his hair long.
Yeah,
his
he had
hair
long hair.
Is like ringlets.
Yeah, he had that perfect 80s mullet. So thank you, Bob Surratt.
Thank you, Bob Surratt.
For making some of us smile. Kristen, how about you? Tell us how you got your start and first jobs.
Well, I'm from Rockford, grew up in Rockford, and never really thought I wanted to be a journalist. Had so many crazy jobs, I can't even tell you, in high school. I worked at a nursing home. My first job was detasseling corn. When I went to school, I worked at a bookshop like in the morning and then went to classes during the day, went to Illinois State. And at some point, there was like a protest or something on campus, and it was really intriguing to me. And so I just started reading the student newspaper more, and I ended up doing an internship there and then got hired. And that's really all I did in college for the next couple years. Was work at my college newspaper, and then got a job at the Pantograph, which was the newspaper in Bloomington Normal. But I was working on the copy desk from 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. and then getting up and going to classes during the day. And my days off were Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So that was not good for my partying.
At least you get two in a row.
That's true.
Right?
Thank
now
you. No one
that,
has
yeah.
ever pointed out the upside of that schedule. But I had just turned 21, and so it wasn't the greatest, you know, party scene. But then I went through this public affairs reporting program at Springfield, which really got me hooked on state government and budget lights and everything that goes into the Capitol in Springfield. And then I worked at the Peoria Journal-Star for a few years, and we'll probably talk about that later, but I was the overnight cops reporter there. Had a couple other jumps and then got into the Chicago market in maybe 1999. So when I was doing all, looking back, I realized I've been a reporter for 24 years, so I feel very old.
I've celebrated my 25th anniversary in the market this year, if you count Joliet as part of that too. I did the same thing. I thought, wait, did I start when I was 12? I don't feel like we started when we were 12. Teen interns, exactly.
Yeah.
So very cool. And I didn't hear you say detasseling corn too, which I know we're gonna touch on. That is a thing, huh?
In Rockford, it is, because it's you're close to Wisconsin. They don't really have the machinery still to do it, so you have to go out in the morning. And I think it's the only job where you can be 14 years old and not violate child labor laws. So as soon as I turned 14, my parents were like, "Go, go, go!"
Right,
and you walk down the rows and pull the something out of the something of the corn.
I don't even know. Orion Samuelson, our agribiz reporter for 50 years here at WGN Radio, talks about one of his first job was at a dairy. Well, he grew up on a dairy farm, and then he would detassel corn, and he would talk about it so passionately. We called it corn porn.
I was not in that category. No. I can tell you that. But
hey, 14 making
14
a salary.
14 and I made some money, and I was out of my parents' hair for half the day. So.
I love it.
They say it's character building. So
there you go, right?
Good honest labor, like journalism.
Yeah, prepared you for what you do today.
Perhaps.
Maybe not so much.
I don't know.
Not so much. Jim Webb, tell us about you and first jobs, where you grew up.
Sure. I actually come from a small town in Ohio as well. I don't know.
Which one? Near.
A little one called Middlefield, outside of Cleveland.
Elyria.
Yeah, okay.
Oh. Even
yep. I am a really tiny town, and I was ready to get out of Ohio, so I went to college out here in Illinois at Bradley University and got my undergrad in journalism. And while I was there, I learned about this public affairs reporting program at Sangamon, what was then Sangamon State, and it's now University of Illinois Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
And so went there, interned with the Associated Press, and kind of caught on at the time with the AP. And proceeded in the course of a short year and a half or two to bounce around the country with the AP. Back in the day, there were a lot of temporary jobs in journalism all over the place, especially in the wire service.
Yeah.
So I think I did, in fast order, 3 months in St. Louis. And at the end of those 3 months, they sent me to Kentucky. I did 3 months in Louisville, Kentucky. That job ended. And there was a three-month tour in Frankfort, Kentucky, covering the 1988 spring session of the Kentucky legislature, which was an exact repeat of the 1987 session of the Illinois legislature. It was weird, bill for bill, practically. So it was easy. So I did that, and then I ended up in Philadelphia for the AP and came back to Chicago in 1989. And I worked at the AP for about until about 2005 in pretty much every job you could do there. Night rewrite, overnights, broadcast, day supervisor. I ended up being the news editor, so oversaw the coverage for the AP for Illinois for 5 years. And then moved on to the Tribune after that as the state and local politics editor for about 5 years. And then for another 5 years or so, I did state and local political investigations. So if it was about Rahm or Madigan or the governors, we usually had a hand in
the imprisoned ones
coverage.
Or the non-imprisoned
in and
or
out.
Both.
Yeah,
okay,
both
right.
Of them, sure.
In and out,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we prefer the latter, but
exactly right.
Yeah.
And some of the stories you've covered we are going to talk about as well. It's Jim Webb, Krista McQuarrie, and Joan Esposito on Andre and the Reporter. Stay with us. Quick break. We'll be back after this on 720 WGN.
Let's get back to Andrea Darlis and the reporters on 720 WGN.
Thank you so much, and welcome back to the program. Joan Esposito, Krista McQuarrie, and Jim Webb, my guest tonight on Andrea and the Reporters. And before the break, you were all talking a little bit about where you've been and first jobs. And we got into it one time on the show, who had the highest starting salary, and I think $14,001 that round on that particular show. As the best one, exactly, yeah. But paying your dues and working these crazy hours in crazy towns and crazy shifts, covering crazy stories, paying your dues is kind of a repetitive theme, you know, for aspiring journalists and millennials listening. And paying your dues is important. But I'm curious, are there any stories that you covered early on in any of your career that really stand out? When I was a young reporter, I was working in Joliet for 4 years, and I would have to go to drive at 3 a.m. to the Will County, the jail, and then the sheriff's office, and then the Joliet Police Department, and go through every police report just to see if I could find a story,
Wow.
Barking dogs. Wow. There was all kinds of fun stuff like that. So anything that stands out as a first story that you might have covered that...
Sadly, much of my career was not memorable back then, or some would argue in my entire career might not be memorable.
Yeah.
So, I was in entertainment television, so my first job was... places to go and things to do, stories on places to go and things to do around Columbus, Ohio. So here's a train you can ride. here's a shop where you can buy candles. Here's a place where you can learn to hang glide. Or here's a place where you can go on a hot air balloon. So I had a lot of fun, but I didn't make any money. I was paid by the story, and I was paid $30 for every story I shot for the show.
Oh, my gosh.
It's not a high-paying profession.
No. A lot of ramen noodles and hot dogs and boiled hot dogs.
I don't even remember having time to eat because, I was, like I said, I was working part-time for a radio station. I anchored the news on Saturday mornings, and I covered the school board and the city council, and I did a public affairs show. And then I was trying to do these stories for the television show. So I don't think there was much eating.
I don't think there was
much eating at all.
Not at all. And you talk about political stories that you've covered, and I refer to, the governors in and out of prison. I don't think we could, some of the stories that occur here in Chicago, I don't think we could script these any better or any crazier, starting with Blagojevich and Ryan, and now now we're making history in a few weeks, too, with Lori Lightfoot being inducted or sworn in as the first black female mayor and openly gay mayor of Chicago. So I think it's a very fun time for journalism. I think it's very...
Chicago, I think, I don't know, you guys might disagree, but I think Chicago politics has always been just as good as Chicago theater. I mean, it's so entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the fact we're all kind of waiting for what's the next turn of the screw with Ed Burke. But the idea that you had this, as you're describing, here's our pinstriped pocket square, fancy watch, Irishman, combed back hair. And he has always been sort of viewed as untouchable, almost like a script.
Right.
And now is he going to be the beginning of, another Operation Greylord or another big tumble of a number of aldermen? We're all sort of waiting to see.
Yeah. You see that too, right, Jim?
Absolutely. It's a never ending story in Illinois and Chicago. I mean, you get asked about it a lot, I'm sure. And being in the business, when you run into people, they want to know what is it about your town or whatever. And I think part of it is there's probably a little more of that activity going on here than many other big cities in the country, although I would say if you go to Louisiana or you try Boston certain decades, you've got plenty of your fair share of that stuff. But it always tends to have a slightly more legendary tint to it in Chicago. And part of that, I think, is the fact that we don't have a lot of celebrities here. We're not New York. We're not L.A. Politicians and, to some extent, journalists and athletes then are kind of the celebrities in Chicago.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest city in the state. And so there's a lot of focus here. And so the people that play on those stages politically have the focus and have a lot of attention from a lot of people. So we look really carefully at it. And they have tended to live up to the most dramatic storylines you could possibly construct.
Yeah. Ripped from the headlines. In fact, they showed a preview for CSI, which is next week, which is where a celebrity makes up a hoax.
Of course.
I thought, oh, my God.
Here we go.
we had to go there,
Exactly.
Chicago is a good model. There still, I think, is, though, to your point, Jim, is this misperception, especially overseas, that Chicago is, Chirac and Al Capone. I mean, I still hear that as recent as a year or two ago.
Yeah. For a while, Michael Jordan distracted people because I would travel and Chicago would be like Michael Jordan, which was such a nice change of pace.
Yeah.
But, now that his celebrity isn't quite as prominent as it was before, I think you're right. I think it's the whole idea of all the shootings.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate too. You've all covered the basic news, the city politics, the state politics. I'm curious though, I want to ask each of you, has there been a story, and I know this is like asking you to pick your favorite child or your favorite parent, but is there a story that's really stood out, something that you've been very passionate about that you've covered at some point in your career that really resonated or stuck with you, Joan?
Well, for most of my career, I was a medical reporter. When I first started at Channel 7, I used to be the murder reporter. It was literally a murder a day. And after a few years, I said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this. But, you know, my background is medical. I understand medicine. I've been a medical reporter before. How about I be medical? So I did that. And generally, those are, you know, they're not the kind of stories where you really break a lot of huge news, though I must say I'm one of the first people who reported that chlamydia existed. So thank you. Thank you.
I didn't know.
Chlamydia in Chicago,
wow,
8 months before it made the cover of Time magazine. Okay.
That's interesting, though. That's very interesting.
But one time at Channel 5, I did do an investigation. There was a doctor out in the suburbs that was horrible, was performing really bad procedures and overcharging his mostly minority, poorer people. And I spent some time interviewing some of the people, and it was a wonderful, dramatic story, not because of me, but because the people were so amazing at telling their stories, and we did put him out of business. So that was as close as I've come to a big medical story that had a real sort of investigative edge to it.
But it makes you feel good, though. You made
a
difference.
It was an amazing story.
People responded.
Yes.
I never knew that about chlamydia, though. That
yes.
I'm always going to remember.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kristen, how about you? You cover politics day in and day out, but is there anything, even early on, a story that just kind of stuck with you or that you were really proud that you broke or covered?
You know, I don't know that. I mean, when I was doing the cops beat, to Joan's point, you know, knocking on someone's door who just lost a loved one or being at the scene of an accident where the family shows up and the coroner is showing up and those are hard to overcome, and that's really, I think, where you get tested. Like, do you really want to do this job? Do you have the nerve to go and try to gather information about someone's loved one when they, you know, are 24 hours past the point of learning that? And I remember getting an interview once. I was trying to find, there was a bunch of high school kids who died in a rural Peoria accident, and I was trying to get interviews with the family. And when they agreed at one point, I hung up the phone and I went, yes. And then I thought, oh my, this is bad. This is bad. Right. Like, I'm happy that I'm getting this interview with this devastated family. Right. And so I tried to sort of wean myself off of that beat after that. I thought, this can't.
You can only take so much of that.
I can't.
Kind of heartache.
I can't keep doing that.
It's very true.
But I would say it didn't really get a lot of attention. It's not something most people probably were paying attention to. But when I was at the Southtown, which covered the South Suburbs, I was kind of obsessed with some of the hijinks that Democrats who were running for office would do to protect themselves on the ballot. And so we talk a lot about what Mike Madigan does now, but back in the early 2000s, he was doing the same thing where he would have an incumbent, he would want to protect that incumbent, so they would load up the ballot with all these, you know, Irish-sounding names so that voters would be confused. You know,
sure.
Kelly Burke is running, so we're going to put Katie McMahon on there and somebody else and split up the vote. And I used to just track them down. I would just go knock on their doors. And I remember going to one woman's door and her mother answered. She was babysitting her grandkids. And I said, oh, I'm looking for your daughter, Elizabeth, who's running for state rep. Can I talk to her? She had no idea, of course, because it was just a game.
Sure.
And so I did that for a number of years every time they tried to load up the ballot. And I would show up at addresses for candidates and the address was, you know, not even a home. It was an empty lot. But the things that the lengths that they would go to protect incumbents really has stuck with me today.
That's incredible. And was there actually, when you would go to the homes, would there actually be people there? Were these real candidates?
They
were not.
It wasn't all the time, but if there was a particular race that he was very interested in, or the Democrats really wanted to get someone elected and they had a competitor, you know, in the primary, they would just do all kinds of little tricks like that, or move polling places at the last minute, or all the ways that they try to kick people off the ballot. It's something I still am interested in, still cover today, but it made me just more kind of ferocious as a journalist. I just thought it was really unfair. Mm-hmm. And and very racially motivated in a lot of cases, where they would be trying to protect a white candidate, so then they would load up the ballot with a bunch of candidates with black sounding names, and you know, it was just wrong. So
it is wrong. I wonder why we get the name of the Windy City sometimes.
Right, right. You know, or our reputation for corruption and
yeah.
Going
you
to
need
all
to change this, Kristen. You need to make this your mission.
I still haven't. I'm still writing about it 24 years
right.
later.
And they see you coming, and they're like, oh, great. Oh,
that does happen.
There
yeah,
she
not
is.
Not in a good way, yeah.
That's good, though. We need you out there to keep doing that. Jim, how about you? Stories that you've covered, something that stands out that's personal to you?
Yeah, I haven't been a reporter for quite a while. I was an editor for probably most of the stories I'm most proud of, yeah. You know, and I had the privilege of working with tremendous journalists everywhere I was at. So I was really lucky that way in my career. We did some very meaningful stories when I was at the AP. Don Babin, who's a really one of those kind of hidden gem reporters for the Associated Press here in Chicago, wrote some of the first stories about the casualties of the Iraq War when Illinois was really on the front line. A lot of National Guard troops from Illinois were over there at the time, and we had some of the first casualties, and he did a number of really great stories touching on the impact that was having in the homeland, you know, from one end of the state to the other, and those were really meaningful to work on. Of course, at the Tribune, was able to do a lot of work. Always had the privilege of working with a lot of very experienced journalists who kind of knew their stuff and knew the political grounds and where the hunting was best and all that. So the Blagojevich coverage that I participated in was pretty important at the time, even at the beginnings of the federal investigation, long before. I always like to say I was done with the story once he was impeached. When he landed back in Chicago, I was done. It was a courthouse folks' job at that point. But the run-up of that, the couple of years before that, documenting the depths to which that administration was going in influence peddling and the access issues and how it hurt the state. I think one of the trickiest things to do as a journalist, and I think it's one of the reasons that corruption ends up sticking around, is putting a price on what that corruption is for regular people, for readers, for taxpayers. I think in the last few years, as social media has taken over, as journalism's changed a little, there are more options in terms of how you can portray that and how forward journalists can be in demonstrating that cost. But it's always been one of the trickiest things is to write a series of stories about, an angle that somebody's taken on state government where a politician or a political player, an influenced person is making out on something. And they take it as a great game or a great, you know, score. Somebody's right. Keeping score, and it's almost entertainment when the coverage comes out, and the regular readers don't really quite get what the price of that is. So exploring how to tell that price has always been important to me. I think the transparency work we worked on when I was at the Trib that continues there and at a lot of news organizations in town has been really, really important, and there's been a trend towards that, especially in the last 8 or 9 years, maybe even less. We're still waiting to see where some of that plays out in town. Those kinds of stories, I think, are really important. They take a lot of time, and they take people who have some experience to work through them. So those are the kind of stories I'm proudest of. Now, I will tell you that as an AP reporter, I found out the power of celebrity. Probably the story I wrote that got the most coverage, the most display, literally around the world. I got clips from South Korea. Was a Three Stooges convention that I covered
oh my gosh,
in 1987 in Philadelphia.
Of course,
so, I knew it was gonna. There was an angle.
I met Larry's sister.
Oh gosh,
and, she was a laugh riot, and that story literally went around the globe. So kind of put me in my place. That's what people really care
what
about.
What people really remember. Right? Yeah, exactly. You know, you did a great job covering the Blagojevich and Ryan, but
you were all over that Three Stooges
as well. No kidding. We're talking to Jim Webb, Kristen McQuarrie, and Joan Esposito, and you brought up an excellent point, Jim, which I want to touch on after this quick break, how social media has changed journalism and the way we write stories and cover stories today. After this on 720 WGN.
Back to Andrea Darlish and the reporters on WGN Radio.
And we are back with Kristen McQuarrie, Jim Webb, and Joan Esposito on Andrea and the Reporters. And before we broke, Jim Webb brought up an interesting comment about how social media has changed the way we cover stories, the way we write. does it, and how much has it affected how we cover stories, Joan?
Well, you know, now we're all multi-platform. Are you multi-platform?
I think I am.
I think you are. We are all multi-platform, a word that 5 years ago I probably couldn't even have defined for you. But, you know, it's social media. You know, you tweet about the people you're going to have on. You tweet about, you send pictures. My show, we stream it on Facebook Live. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to get to the point where we can actually take clips that have just aired and turn them around and put them on social media. Not quite there yet. But, you know, I mean, trying to figure out the hashtags that amplify, mm-hmm. that amplify. I am now amplified right. as well as multi-platform. Who knew?
Who knew, right? 2019. Do you think this is, in a way, I think it's good because it broadens your audience. But my fear, I think, is rushing to put that out may diminish the accuracy of the story.
Or if I'm trying to tweet while I'm interviewing you, am I really giving you 100% of my attention and really listening to what you're saying?
Right.
And it's really hard. It's like there's not enough brain power to go around sometimes to do these things all at once. And to make them meaningful, they kind of have to be done within a certain framework.
I mean, when I started reporting, if I wanted to look at somebody's campaign fund disclosure forms, I had to drive to Springfield, get microfilm, sit down there and flip through it. There was a dial-up internet connection in the newsroom that nobody knew how to use.
Right.
So I'm sort of conflating like internet with social media. But just in that regard, it's become so much easier mm-hmm. as a reporter to just do these quick turnaround stories connecting a campaign contribution to a contract or something right. like that. In terms of social media, I've gotten used to it, but I'm still uncomfortable with it. There's this whole effort to sell yourself. And to your point, we have like a chalk beat up at the Tribune, which is just like a digital minute by minute. What are people clicking on? So mm-hmm. it might be something really important, like an investigation the newsroom just did on DCFS, or it might be what are the best French fries in Chicago.
Right.
But so there's all this pressure to be clicked upon and to build an audience. And I think it's just made us all, I mean, I write opinion, so I'm sort of free of this, but
sure.
it's made us all a lot less objective. I mean, you can tell by going through someone's Twitter feed a lot of the time where they fall politically. And then if they're writing a story about politics, it's just, it compromises us right. in a way. And I just think, like, especially in print, I think people who go into print, when we started, we were behind the screen. Nobody was doing podcasts and right. television shows, and right. we preferred it that way. You know, yep. I didn't even like my byline is my maiden name. It's not even my married name, because you wanted like a sense of privacy and sure. not putting yourself out there. And this has just changed that. It's kind of forced a transformation, I think, especially from old print journalists like me, who when you got into it, you were really always in the background.
Yeah, I agree completely. Mm-hmm. As an even older print journalist, I get to sound like the old man a lot when I get on this stump. And I think that especially spending, you know, 20 years or more of my career as an editor, social media has taken the editor out of the equation. And I think that's frankly the difference between professional journalism and what everybody is doing these days.
Right.
I think that you need, you know, I bemoan every time I think there was just a headline the other day out of maybe Kansas City, another copy desk going away. We're just losing the people that helped us be sure we were right.
Mm-hmm.
And social media literally takes it out of the equation. The concept is to be snappy and quick and say something that people will remember. And that was not the bar back in the day when there was, you know, competition for who was first in the old days, as
right.
they say, right?
Right.
At the wire service, the AP versus UPI. You know, I remember when CNN came on the scene. I'm old enough to have been working when that happened.
Yeah.
And you could immediately see how the game was going to change, right?
Right, because it was 24-hour news.
A picture of a thing became the news
right.
rather than what that picture was about. A school bus in a ditch outside of St. Louis shot by a traffic helicopter was a big news story when, in fact, there were no kids on the bus and the driver was uninjured. And one phone call would tell you that. But all of a sudden, it's on CNN or another national
right.
network.
And it's repeated over and over.
And it's repeated over and over again. And and then the notion that you have to fill all that time.
Right.
And social media picked that up. I think it came along at exactly the time that major news organizations, be they broadcast or print, were starting to whittle back a lot of the core services that aren't sexy, that nobody really knows about, they don't see because it's editors who are never on the street or never public, never on TV.
Right.
And as those things were going, it became helpful to major news organizations to have reporters out front more, because it certainly created the appearance that they were doing as much, they were in as many places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can sit at a desk and tweet all day long about a thing that happened in Peoria.
Right.
And you were never there. You used to need the wire service for that.
Or now be on the scene,
somebody.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it feeds, I think, a little bit of our worst impulses.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I would agree with Kristen that, one, the internet has changed everything and has made reporting so much easier, and it's made information so much more accessible to everybody. And
right.
It's good to have citizen journalists, and it's great to have it. But I think we've lost track of how much we undercut ourselves when we get out there on social media and go with opinion over fact. And I don't, if you're in the opinion business, that's great. You should sell it as hard as you can sell it out there.
Right.
But if you're in the news gathering side and you're venturing into getting into a dispute with a source you're covering, which is more common than ever, when you've got people covering the White House for the New York Times who are getting in disputes with administration officials on social media, I don't see how that helps journalists.
Yeah, no. Hmm. I agree. You were going to say, Joan?
Well, he said something that triggered a memory, but it was you know, the opposite of what you were saying is true as well. I mean, in my years in television news, sometimes it was hard to get the news desk to agree to cover a story if there weren't pictures,
right?
Like a budget thing,
yep,
or money misspent. And I can't tell you how many times they'd look at me and say, "What are the pictures? Yep. What are the pictures?"
Right. And that's,
and then, you know, it's like, okay, well, luckily after a time we got those machines that would make graphics, so then we could do pie charts, and you know, they could swivel, and then it was a little easier to do those stories, because otherwise you're taking pictures of papers,
right?
You know,
right.
here are the numbers. And so it was hard sometimes. You say that sometimes a story was just the pictures, and sometimes a story that had no pictures, it was a really hard sell.
Mm-hmm. Right. What advice would you have for young journalists? I even hesitate to say millennials, because, you know, we give tours oftentimes here at the radio station, and there's these young journalists, and they're so excited, and they're so inspired, and they say, well, I want to do this, and I want to do this, and I want a podcast, and I want to do this. What advice would you have for journalist just starting out?
Well, if I could steal a Carol Marine story.
Yeah.
She told me that she was over at some friend's house, and their young daughter came up and her mom was like, oh, she wants to be an anchor woman. And Carol was like, well, do you love information? You know, do you really love digging up facts? And do you want to read information, and do you want to know things? And she said, then she paused, and the little girl looked at her and said, I think I want to be a beauty queen.
Oh, right. Sure. Yeah. It's that misperception. Sure.
Yeah. And also,
not that Carol isn't, because she's a beautiful
woman. The one thing that I...
She was a beauty queen.
I know. She's both.
Yeah.
The one thing that I tell people who want to be television journalists is, don't think that you're going to make a lot of money, because the people always think, Ron Majors, rolling in dough. And maybe Ron Majors, God love him, was, but most of those big anchor jobs don't exist anymore, and 95% of the jobs pay very low wages, right. Very low wages.
Yeah.
I think you have to be willing to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't, just because you just graduated from a big fancy journalism school, you still might be out covering, doing a feature story on a new sewage plant opening up in your town.
Right.
And so being curious about everything is important. But practically speaking, I tell students to become an expert at something. Maybe it's agriculture, maybe it's transportation.
Right.
Maybe it's Boeing's latest this or that. I mean, every trade organization, even if you have to get your foot in the door, needs an expert in some area. So train yourself in a subject area that interests you is another one. But you know, I edited obits, and we've talked about, you have to be willing to move around. I mean,
sure.
Jim
mm-hmm.
talked about moving all over the place, and AP was known for that. You really had to be willing to uproot and go wherever.
Yeah. We used to read the obituaries in Joliet, and it was sponsored by the local funeral home, too.
Yeah.
So-and-so mm-hmm. passed away Wednesday, the age of 93.
Yep.
It's really hard for aspiring journalists or new journalists because they have to be more expert at more things than we ever had to be when we were starting out.
That's true.
And at the same time, there are far fewer opportunities for them to hone their skills, to cut their teeth. You know, there, to your point, there's not a lot of obit writers left. There's not that many different organizations that will have three or four or five cub reporters, if you will, who go out and just do whatever, or who do the rewrite desk at the yeah. AP, et cetera. That, you know, there were 22 people in the Chicago Bureau of the AP
wow.
When I was there. And there are far, far fewer now. Just
two.
A handful of people that do Chicago.
Right.
And the same thing with every radio station and, sure. and every TV station. So there's fewer places for you to go practice and make a mistake. Really, mm-hmm. that's the way you learn, is you make a lot of mistakes. It is better if you make them in a smaller newspaper yes. or a smaller radio station
oh, yeah.
than
in
a bigger one, right? I mean, yeah, you know, the time I reported that a town blew up in Kentucky on the night desk at the AP in Louisville, I'm glad that, you know, I had time to fix it before anybody noticed.
Oh, yeah.
Do that here, and it's pretty much into your career.
Oh, completely, mm-hmm.
you know?
Completely.
So,
I've been to city council meetings where they argue over the closure of a bridge or whether or yeah. not to reopen it for 4 hours, so...
You yeah, learn by sure. doing, right? And you right. learn by interacting with people, because so much of journalism is about making a personal connection to the people or the thing you're covering.
Yeah.
And you have to get that experience, and you better love it at this point if you really want to get into it, because it really seems to be harder than it ever has been.
I agree. Yeah. Harder than ever.
And I used to also tell graduates, you know, when I got into the field, it wasn't as popular as it became. Mm-hmm. And every year, so many schools graduating, so many journalism, communications people. And, you know, the jobs aren't multiplying as fast as there are new graduates, especially not in television.
Right.
I mean, there's a finite number of stations, a finite number of people who work in those newsrooms, and there isn't all that much turnover from year to year for people to get in and move up.
It's sad to say, but I always tell people, if you really love it, have a backup plan anyway. Right?
Have a plan B.
Do anything, but have
advice.
A plan B.
Yep, for everything. Krista McQuarrie, Jim Webb, and Joan Esposito. Final thoughts with these three esteemed journalists after this on 720 WGN.
What happened? What's happening? What's yet to come? It's Andrea Darlis and the reporters on 720 WGN.
We are back with Joan Esposito, Jim Webb, and Kristen McQuarrie. Our final thoughts here on Andrea and the reporters. So people know Joan. People know Kristen. People know Jim. People know your names. I want to know what is next for you. What's next on your agenda? Is there a story that you're still chasing, a project that you're passionate about, something you still want to do within the next year or two or three, Joan?
Well, our station covers liberal progressive politics. And so for me, the next big thing coming up is the Democratic Convention in Milwaukee. So we're already making plans for how we're going to cover it, what we're going to do. And that's going to be really big. And after that, I plan to drop over in a coma.
It's a great plan.
That's
Thank
good.
You. Thank
That's
you.
Good.
Been
Kristen,
working on it.
How about you?
I mean, just in terms of like stories, I was at WBEZ for a while before I came to the Tribune. And learning radio was awesome, by the
yeah.
way. Just clips and being able to have a sign off was so cool. But there was that Save Abandoned Babies Act, where people can drop off their infants at fire stations. And I started writing about that when it first became a law. And then when I went to WBZ, I traced like the first 25 babies who had been left on the doorsteps of people's homes or I'm sorry, libraries or police stations
sure.
or whatnot, and been adopted out, and kind of found them and got familiar with the foster care system in Illinois. And so now I'm writing a lot about all the failures of DCFS. And that's just... that's another story that just weighs on you
yeah.
is this
mm-hmm.
latest case with AJ Friend. And it just,
that's a gut-wrenching case.
It's awful. But we can't just keep settling for cases where DCFS has all this contact with families. On the personal side, people have always said, like, do you have a book in you? You should write about it. I write all day long. I have no interest in sitting down and...
What about
and,
putting all your columns in a book? I know my mom would buy multiple copies.
I have one reader.
Right?
Thank you. But I started in my 40s running a little bit because I was, you know, weight was climbing up. And so on Sundays, I run with this running group, and there's a retired judge. There's someone who is very influential in the Daley administration. We all run together now. And I feel like there's a story there. Just they've been through tragedy, some of them, in their own personal lives. Running itself is just it's so hard on your body, and it's such a mental thing that it's been just an eye-opening experience for me. And they're all historians. One is a retired federal agent. They have great stories about Chicago history. So if I have a book in me, it will combine the elements of that.
Can I have a suggested title
yes.
for you? Yes. Running with You, Not From You.
Yes. Excellent.
Kristen McQuarrie.
Exactly.
The true story.
There we go.
Very cool.
Thank
How about you, Jim Webb? What's next for you?
I want you to join me in the marketing field.
I'm Andy, right there. I'm not far behind you.
Good. You're right there. I'm not sure. I like to tell people that I spent 30 years as a journalist spending other people's money and asking where the rest of it was. And now I'm working at a small business and having to learn that you actually have to make money or people don't eat every day. So,
right.
So I'm still learning that, and I find it fascinating. It's been a great challenge for me. I work with a young staff of folks who are really spirited and really into what they do for a living, and I derive a lot of energy from that, and I've got a little different perspective now from the business side. So I'm still learning my way. I think there might be something in writing down the road for me. I just can't figure out what it is. And in the meantime, I sit here and I watch what's going on in town with the media and journalism and watch how that's evolving, and have lots of friends still on that side of the street or that
right.
side of the microphone, and worry a little, but I'm constantly amazed by what people are still doing. You know, I think the rise of the nonprofits in journalism in Chicago is a heck of a story. Mm-hmm. The partnerships that are going on, whether it's the BJ with the Sun Times or BEZ, and I know the Tribune's looking at stuff with ProPublica or has done
right.
stuff with ProPublica.
Sure.
I think the rise of those kind of partnerships
yeah.
are a way to try to transform journalism and keep it going in this town and keep it vibrant because it's urgently needed. So I'm really excited about watching that, and I have so
yeah.
many friends doing that. Just I'm trying to, I guess, live vicariously
yeah.
just a little bit through that.
You can live vicariously through
Thank
all of this.
You.
And I think this.
Yeah,
I think when Mayor-elect Lightfoot is sworn in, I think it's going to be a very interesting time for mm-hmm. Chicago politics. I think we're going to see a brand new city council, and we're going to see a lot of changes. For better or for worse is yet to be seen, but I think it will be a little bit for the better. So. I look
it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing how all of you will cover that. So, Joan, where can people find you?
2 p.m. to 5 p.m., a.m. 8:20, Monday through Friday.
Very good. And you're on social media as well?
I am, at Joan Esposito, C-H-I. That's my Twitter handle. I have a Twitter handle.
Wow. See, all these
I'm
things you
high.
Never thought you would say.
Kristen,
yes.
where can we read you and find you?
I have a column on Tuesdays, and then I write editorials that are mostly about state government, politics, pensions, education policy.
Social media as well?
Yes, I am at Statehouse Chick. It was a name given to me when I was the Chicago News Cooperative, another stop along the way,
yeah.
and I just kept it, because why not?
Very nice. I love it. And Jim, how about you as well?
Sure.
You're on Twitter.
You can find me on Twitter at James E. Webb, and my old byline. And our website is seraphim.com.
You guys, thank you so much. Please come back on the program again, and we'll have lots to discuss once the mayor is sworn in. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.